Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
All right. Live from the gleaming, streamlined, state-of-the-art studios of OutlawRadioLive.com, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area. Following program is produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. Standard of a beleaguered and tempest-tossed broadcast industry. I am the legendary Burl Bear, that man over there. You can see him, can't you? That's Mark C.G. Boyer, fact-checker, co-host extraordinaire. And, hey, Art D. Fisher, scariest man in comics.
There we go.
There you are. Hey, it's been 14 years since you've been on the show. Time goes by so quickly.
I have totally missed you guys. I totally missed doing the show. You guys are wonderful. And it's funny that I'm on the show now because last night I just finished my editorial for the new Jeffrey Dahmer book.
Oh, that thing refuses to die.
I know. I didn't plan on ever reprinting this book, but because of Netflix's lies and distortions about my work, I had to reprint the books.
Well, of course, and you had to make more money.
Well, it's not really about the money for me so much. It's about you're lying about me. You're lying about my book, so therefore I'm going to make my book available again 30 years later.
Well, you should. Not that it was a masterpiece when it first came out. But
It was what it was.
It was interesting.
I would call it a good experiment.
Yes, and it got you a lot of notoriety. You wound up on every bizarre talk show being vilified.
Even having my house protest marched.
Yeah, they had a big protest in front of your house, and I like the way you dealt with it. Did you hide under the floorboards?
No, you brought them cookies and milk.
Barbecue and a live band.
I had a keg. I had watermelon. I had a barbecue because it is Dahmer.
Yeah.
And I had a band. I had a live band, and the police made me shut down the band. I've got people yelling at me with bullhorns from the sidewalk, but they shut down my band over a noise violation. Yeah. Life is funny.
So this is Mark over in the corner here. I was wondering what were some of the things that Netflix got wrong about you?
Well, the thing about Netflix is, A, you know, it's funny when you have a story like the Jeffrey Dahmer story, and they go to pitch it and they go to sell it. One, they never got my permission to put the books in the film, which is something I'm used to. I mean, I'm a professional. I'm in the entertainment business. I do American Horrors. I have a TV channel that runs all day, all night, all horror. American Horrors.
Yes.
And I've been doing it since I first met Burl. And so we've been now streaming since October 2nd, 2011. And we've got a pretty good viewership. So I'm a pro. So if you want to put my books in your show, call me up. I'll sign the release, and it'll no problem, because that's how it works when you're a professional. But Netflix didn't do that. They Photoshop altered my books. They went into the cover, and they put their actor on the cover of the book. and then they also did weird Photoshop altering of my book, Jeffrey Dahmer versus Jesus Christ, and it's my artwork. I drew the cover. So they did weird stuff, like they Photoshopped Jeffrey Dahmer and Jesus fight, okay? And, of course, Jesus beats the ever-loving shit out of Dahmer.
Well, woman, ho.
I've been practicing with Bruce Lee. So they Photoshopped the cross. He had a cross on his boxing shorts, and they took it from the front of the shorts and put it on the side. They did weird stuff like that. They never got my permission to put any of my work in the show. So they also talk shit about the books. Like, there's a scene in the show, like, about episode 9, I think, and they're portraying the victims' families in a completely disingenuous light. I mean, I know these women because I was on all these talk shows with them. And they sued me. So they sued me in court over the Dahmer book. And you get involved with people when you're involved in litigation. That's the sad truth about being in court, is you're going to be doing a dance with whoever you're in court with. So in the show, they're sitting there talking about, hey, lady, look at this. They're making Dahmer a superhero now. No, I never, ever aggrandized Dahmer. I find him repulsive. I find serial killers repulsive. I have never in my career celebrated serial killers the way that they seem to do on all these shows. So they talk about me without using my name. And they talk about the book, and they pass the book around the table in the scene, and they're going, oh, they're making him a superhero. Well, we tried to sue him, and that didn't work. I've had it up to here with this First Amendment stuff. But they're lying about the contents of the book. I'm not even going to read it. I hope Jesus wins. Well, hey, asshole, you know Jesus wins.
Usually does.
Like they're being disingenuous about what's in the content of the book, which is what they've always done when they discuss my work on these shows. That's the one that really sticks in my craw, is the lying about the content. Like, you know Jesus wins in the book. Why are you portraying it as if he doesn't win? Why are you portraying it as if I'm aggrandizing this piece of crap? That's my problem with Netflix. And they could have simply been professionals and actually gotten a release from me on the book.
Did they ever say anything to you like, gee, we're sorry we said those rude things?
Oh, hell no. You know, Burl, you're an entertainment professional. They never, ever want to admit any wrongdoing or anything like that. I've actually been even talking to lawyers about whether or not I should sue them.
And what did the lawyers say? Don't bother?
Mm-mm. No, the lawyers want to sue them.
Oh,
well, yeah, they want money.
They didn't get rights to the books. They want money. A lawyer wants money.
Yeah, that's...
God rest Don Waldman's soul. Don, I miss that man so much. But he would agree. Lawyers want money.
Yep, Don would agree.
Yeah, considering what he charged an hour, I'd say so.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Oh, yeah. What do you guys think? Do you guys think I should bother?
Well,
I think that you should have your a reputable firm with some clout. You know, send them a nice note asking them in future viewings to acknowledge, you know, that your permission wasn't granted. Something like that.
And they altered the work. They altered the artwork.
Yeah,
and
so
I think I have different rights to, when you're the artist and you draw a piece of art, you have different rights than when you publish a book.
True.
You know what I mean? Like yes. You have different rights to the work, and they're showing my artwork that they altered without my permission.
Yeah, just a disclaimer, you know, that your work is here without permission, and some of it has been altered for dramatic effect for the show.
Because I'm reprinting the book now. I did not ever plan on reprinting the Dahmer book. It was one of those things that happened in my life, and I was ready to walk away from that chapter until all of a sudden the Netflix show shows up in the summer of 2022, and I'm like, what? Hart, your stuff's in there. What? You're kidding me. Because it's normal for me to sign a release because my work is in, John Waters' film Serial Mom with, God, I can't remember the actress's name. Great actress, too. But it's Serial Mom, and my comics are in it. Or Scream 2, my comics are in it. Or The Salton Sea with Val Kilmer. It's a revenge film, and it involves a bunch of meth heads.
Serial Mom.
And in the house where all the meth heads do their drugs, the whole wall of their shooting gallery is covered with artwork from my comic books.
Wow.
And I just signed a release, and it was fine. I'm a pro. So my work and my comics have been featured in several films, and it was always no problem. Like, okay, send me a release. Here you go. Or maybe sometimes they're like, we want this particular comic book. Well, it's $3.95. Here you go.
Yeah.
Kathleen Turner and Suzanne Summers.
There you go. Yes, Kathleen Turner. Fantastic actress. I like her a lot, especially in Body Heat.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, she was definitely edible.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Right? Well, the serial mom, it was cool because she was this 1950s kind of mom, and she was a serial killer. And in her collection of memorabilia, she had the Jeffrey Dahmer comic book.
And well, she should have.
Yeah, and John Waters was a fan. You know, he's a big fan of, like, different counterculture and sort of stuff. So the Dahmer book was something that he got a kick out of, you know. I did this biography on Jeffrey Dahmer. A reporter bought the book at a comic book store and bragged about it and brought it over to the victims' families' homes. He ambush interviewed them on their porch with my comic book. I never thought that the victims' families were going to be in a comic book store buying this book. That never occurred to me. And so the idea of a news reporter doing this and provoking them with this, what to do as a human being.
Yeah.
To take something like that and to provoke the parent or the relative of a murdered loved one and provoke them, ambush, interview them on their front porch. I always thought that was pretty horrid, and I never understood why I'm the villain here when they're the ones provoking these folks.
And I also have the feeling that the people who were bitching about your book never read it.
Correct. And I did a biography book on it, and it's 24 pages of story, so it's not even that in-depth. You know, how deep can you get in 24 pages?
You can't. I mean, you cover the basic chronology of events with some typos and some misspellings. But, you know, there's nothing objectionable about it.
When I did the book, I was a bouncer at a local bar. I'd just gotten out of college. I was a very young creator. And I just did the best job I could at the time because as you're a creator and as you're an artist, you get skills. You get better. You get better at your job. You become a better writer. And I didn't read the book for a long time until John Borowski did Serial Killer Culture. And he does a lot of really good true crime documentaries. I think John's one of the best who covers this kind of content. And he had me read the book out loud in his documentary, Serial Killer Culture. And that's when I had to, I got to look at the book with a different eye. It was like 10, 12, 13 years later. I had not really looked at the book, and I was like, wow, Hart, this is a lot better than you thought it was. Because you know, Burl, as a writer, aren't you your harshest critic?
Oh, yeah. In fact, my editor at Kensington, Pinnacle True Crime, gave me advice that don't read your reviews on Amazon. I said, why is that? So the ones that you remember are going to be the ones from the trolls that say what a horrible book it is and give it one star, and that's what they do. They never, I mean, stop and think about it. If you read a book, I mean, if I'm going to review a book and recommend it, it's going to be one I really like, you know? And if I read one that I don't like, I'm not going to review it, you know? But if you see
that, admit, Burl, since you and I were hanging out, since you and I knew each other in Los Angeles, I moved to the Midwest, so I'm living in Wisconsin now, and I'm in Lake Geneva. And when I moved here, I started to get therapy from a doctor. So I've been going through therapy with a psychiatrist, and she's a war veteran. She's a lieutenant colonel in the Army. And she diagnosed me with PTSD from all... I've had a violent life, very violent life. And I didn't know I had PTSD.
You figured it out, though, eventually.
Yeah, eventually. So it's interesting to be doing this, to even be on this show with you, because I've got so many good memories about the True Crimes group, and I still play our True Crimes TV show on American Horrors.
Well, good. I've never seen them. I remember doing them, but I've never seen them.
I should set up like a Dropbox for you, and I could give you the shows.
Oh, that'd be great.
I've got three of them. There's you and me and Don. And one of them was we interviewed an expert on bank robbery, a sheriff.
Right.
And another was the gentleman, I think he wrote The Changeling. And it was all about child sex crimes. And then the third one...
The woman who was the policewoman in Las Vegas.
Yeah, yeah. Sheriff was from Las Vegas, that's correct.
Yeah, that was a good book. She was an interesting woman. She really went through hell in Vegas. They gave her, the cops gave her a bad time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't all just donuts and bright lights.
So it's a real sincere pleasure to be talking to you, and I'm so happy you're still alive, you old bastard.
So am I.
Yeah, well, she died at least four times.
I died at least four times since I've seen you.
But really?
Yeah, they brought me back.
You know, and we're suing the doctors.
We're suing the doctors for bringing me back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I dealt with that with my wife. My wife passed. She had a terrible battle with severe anemia and colon cancer, and I had Waka die in my arms twice.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, and the one time she came back, I was going to do CPR on her, and I was just about to do the where you breathe into them, and right when my lips touched her, like Prince Charming, she came back to life.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty insane.
Amazing stuff. My daughter saved my life this year, because the dog was barking because I hit the floor, and the dog woke her up, and there I was on the floor, not breathing, and she gave me CPR, called 911, and I had to call the ambulance to take my daughter to the hospital last week, and when the EMT showed up, and he saw me, I said, "It's not me this time," because they'd come and got me twice this year.
That's rather expensive.
Well, actually,
my mom had a brain tumor, and she had surgery to remove the tumor, and it was during the lockdown, and they weren't doing proper medical care too soon, and so I showed up at my childhood home to have with her, and catatonic in a chair in the middle of the living room, and if I had not gotten there, she would have been dead in about an hour.
Yep.
I showed up at exactly the right moment, got her to the ER, handled all that. And the funniest part about it was she had been drinking a lot of water. She'd had this surgery and her head was hurting her. So she'd been drinking too much water. And so the salinity was gone in her body. So her brain wasn't functioning. So when I got her out of this chair, he pissed all over my feet. It was like a bucket of water hit my feet. I was wearing flip-flops. It was the summer, but I saved her life, and I got her the ER, and that's something I can look in the mirror and be like, dude, you did it. You saved your mom for real.
Yeah, that's amazing. My daughter went to the one hospital, whose name I probably shouldn't mention because I don't want anyone to go there. She has severe pneumonia. They did absolutely that and had the ambulance come and take her. Her oxygen level was 48, which is just about being dead.
Well, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
And it was the same at the other hospital, who didn't do anything. They just, okay, nice to see you. But so she's been in the hospital for about a week in the ICU, but she gets to go home tonight with oxygen. But,
you wouldn't think it, but I got to say that I've been in and out of a lot of hospitals in my time, and I would say that the medical care that my wife received in Wisconsin was better than the medical care she received in Los Angeles, which you wouldn't think that, right, being a big city.
It really varies from hospital to hospital here.
Yeah, yeah, it really does. And I was in Glendale. So when I was dealing with some of Waka's health issues in Los Angeles, we were dealing with the hospital in Glendale. And I'll tell you straight up, I got to thank the people in Wisconsin. I got to thank the medical care that she got in Wisconsin was really a lot better. It really was. And I'm not living in a big city. I'm in Lake Geneva, which is kind of a party town. It was one of the places where Playboy had a club. Cheap Trick recorded records here. It's a beautiful place. It's beautiful, but it's not a big city. So it's kind of interesting to see that their medical care was so damn good.
My daughter for a while was down in the jungle L.A., where the where things aren't good, and a kid was shot.
Mm-hmm.
Someone did like a drive-by, just shot into a car and hit this kid who was a passenger. And he died in my daughter's arms. She had called the ambulance, and the hospital was just down the road. It took like almost an hour for the ambulance to show up, and the kid had died in my daughter's arms before the ambulance got there. Ambulance picked up the kid and didn't declare him dead until after they got him to the hospital. Because it was that part of town where they're not that eager to go to pick people up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know,
and I get that completely.
Yeah. And, you know, for some reason that reminds me of... I did a book called Headshot.
Oh, hold up.
Mark keeps track of when I plug my own books.
Yeah, 26 minutes in.
26 minutes in. Burl plugs one of his own books.
On your book, you let us know.
Burl plugs his own book.
Yeah.
Burl, don't feel bad because I remember when I was doing Heart Attack Radio, Walker would always yell at me like, "You keep talking about yourself. What do you have to say?"
Anyway, in that one, we're complaining. The defense attorney was so mad at the prosecutor for prosecutorial misconduct that he ran against him in the next election to be prosecutor and won. My cousin, who was an attorney in that town, was reading the book, and he came to me and said, "The guy that became the prosecutor, former defense attorney, had more prosecutorial misconduct than the guy he replaced."
Oh, my God. I tell you, you know what's funny is now, I mean, we've been friends for a while. We've known each other for a while. And so on Fridays, I have drinks. I call it my vodka clutch because I have gimlets. And I drink with a judge from Chicago in Cook County.
What?
We hang out and talk about different cases and different stuff. And one of the coolest things that he did is when he was a lawyer, back in Chicago, there was a black mayor, and Mayor Washington, and there was a story in which an artist drew Mayor Washington in drag, and it was hanging in a museum in Chicago, and some of the city council members ran into the museum and yanked the painting off the wall.
Whoa.
There was a lawsuit involved, and this judge, when he was a lawyer, represented the artist over that case.
Strange days.
Very interesting.
I wanted to talk to you about American Horrors.
Sure.
What kind of content do you have on the channel?
All right, well, let me slip into the professional mode. Hi, I'm Harkey Fisher from American Horror. All day, all night, all horror, American Horrors. From the VHS era of horror. When my wife was going through her first cancer in 2006 and 2007, we kind of noticed that there wasn't anything. TV was really savage. It still is. And it's all about conflict. So there was nothing for her to tune out to. She just watched Big Cat Diaries on the Discovery Channel, which is hilarious because, like, I can't handle this talk show crap, but I can watch lions kill gazelles.
Well, you know,
the gazelles don't even get a chance to say anything about it.
Yeah, so American Horrors is meant to be, the catchphrase we came up with my buddy Groovy was good time horror. And it's a horror television channel, like an old school 1970s TV channel, where you don't quite know the schedule. Okay, we don't post, and so it's a linear streaming channel that plays horror films, and I do the programming. So I personally, myself, program, it's like an edit to me, it's a paper edit, and so I'm programming a browser called Mutant, and so I'll have like three movie trailers will show up in front of the film. There's a warning, you've got a feature film, there's no commercials during the movie. Because my feeling is that when you put a commercial in, you're going to wreck this.
You break continuity.
Yeah, you break continuity and you take somebody out of the moment.
Oh, and I hate it when they do the commercial break right at a pivotal moment in the film.
I like Tubi. I think Tubi's a pretty good service, but you keep getting these commercial horror films.
Especially when you get to the last half hour of the film, but every 7 minutes they stop it to do 3 minutes of commercials.
Yeah, just like when I was a kid watching James Bond on the ABC Sunday Night Movie. The first half hour, there was like no commercials, but by the last half hour, there's a gazillion commercials.
Oh, yeah.
With the ninjas coming out of the volcano, and Bond is going to fight somebody.
Oh, that's like if you try to watch a movie on FilmRise.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, having nightmares with commercials in them.
There's too many. So my commercials, they come in after the movie. And we have original programming, like True Crimes, the show that Burl and I did. We did three episodes, and there's another one that's on the editing room that we did called True Crimes. It was like in Don Waldman's backyard by the pool, and it's cut. But I haven't gotten it on the air yet.
Oh, good.
But I'm going to.
So,
this year is going through all the old post-production stuff and finding all the gems that got passed over that didn't get finished.
Now, are you doing analog or digital editing on this stuff?
Digital editing. As an editor, I'm cutting everything on the computer, and okay, the funny part about American Horrors is this. There is not one other channel in the world where one man has designed everything. Like all the logos, all the bumpers. I've either directed them, I've had a hand in making the music. So the thing about American Horrors that's really special is it's got this vibe like your favorite local restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so personal. It's really personal. I've got the channel playing all the time. So if I get bored with the channel, I know my audience is bored. So I'll change things. And we have feature films. We have original programming, Gorecast, Mission Terror, The American Horror Show, The American Horrors Intermission, Riffhead. We have our own programming. And I feel that IFC's dick in the dirt. I think I totally wrecked them. It's original. It's fun. It really kind of reminds me of like a UHF channel, but more professional than that.
The snow channels when I was growing up.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun. I really love what I do with the network, and I really enjoy programming. We play old commercials. Like, I'll have Dick Cavett narrating the seal of approval. We're not going to have bad guys as heroes. We're good broadcasters. We're nice guys. And then I'll follow it up with a commercial from Joe Friday going, cigarettes are safe. Chesterfields are fine.
ABC, always buy Chesterfield.
That's one of the hardest things to do in entertainment, is to make the bad guy a hero.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes that's why Charles Manson's popular. I mean, when Charles Manson was going to release his country album, he came to me.
Yeah, and who could blame him? You know, the Beach Boys, was it the 2020 album, has, what, three songs by Charles Manson?
His record was good. The music was good, and he wanted all the proceeds to go to some charity for whales.
Well, the whales need as much charity as they can get.
Yeah, right? So, at the time, I was like, you know, thank you, but I'm doing TV. I'm not a record label. I don't have that distribution. But it was an honor that they came to me with the project.
Yeah. Now, you doing new content and older horror films?
I'm doing both. I'm a director.
Yeah, doing both. But I just wanted to get your take on the current state of horror that's out now.
It's an interesting time to be involved in horror because, like we mentioned, Tubi, right? So when I first started my channel, when we first went on the air in 2011, I totally could see the influence we had because that's when all of a sudden Turner Classic Movies, TCM, all of a sudden decided to do Turner Underground. And I started to see the movies that I was playing trailers for show up on their network. And I knew that Turner Classic Movies, this is not your genre, guys. I know this is not your genre. So I could see the influence I was having because I'm a Hollywood animal, and I live in L.A., and I knew that we were influencing people because we're entertaining. Because at the end of the day, that's what I feel most channels have forgotten, is your job is to be entertaining. Your job isn't commentary. Your job is not fucking social justice warriors. Shut up. Jesus, shut up. Stop with your social justice DEI crap. Your job is to entertain people because life is hard. Life is difficult. And so when you turn on that channel, the idea is you're checking out. You need to check out. You want to get out of your life.
Right.
And you want to take a break. And you just want to be entertained. That's the mantra of American horrors. And that's why we call it good time horror. I don't play torture porn.
Right. You know, that's why when you tune in, you want to watch carnivorous human underground dwellers eat people.
My feeling about horror is that the best horror films at their core are mysteries. I really feel that. The best ones, Psycho, the best horror films are all mysteries. The original slasher films, Friday the 13th, the first film, is a mystery.
Who's the slasher? What's
the thing in the dark? What is that? That, to me, is what American Horrors is about, is what's lurking in the darkness.
Thing you mentioned about wanting to check out, I never understood that until I was going through an emotional crisis, and I turned on TV, and there was Gilligan's Island, which I'd never been into, and suddenly, I'm watching it, and I got it. I understood. I could watch that, and my problems vanished, and I was on this island with Gilligan and the professor, and it was a vacation, and
I really thought when Walker was recovering from cancer and she had been eviscerated by her chemo and her radiation, she was a skeleton. It was so horrible. Like, all the muscle on her feet was gone. So I'd have to rub her feet all the time because the pads of her feet were gone. It was just bone.
Wow.
So when she said, I needed a checkout, I really understood that because she was so devastated. So American Horrors, in between the horror films, it's all fun. Like, I've been doing a lot of acting since you and I talked last. And so I've been acting in these films. And normally when I act, I kind of end up playing myself. It's kind of funny. I get cast as Hart. And that's my name in the movie. It's Hart Fisher. It's hilarious. So I try really hard to, in between the horror films, keep it funny. Keep it funny, because you can't be at 11 all the time.
I'm a huge fan of horror from my childhood. You said you're in L.A. That when I was growing up, there were fake programs on Saturday, Friday night, where they showed these old horror movies. You know, this is before Elvira. This is before Elvira came out, and they were always making fun of what was being shown.
Yeah,
and there was a movie theater in the Valley, the Reina Theater. It's on Ventura Boulevard, and it was a revival theater. So they would do a month of westerns, a month of detectives, a month of horror. And since I was too young to go and see them, I would climb up the fire escape into the bathroom upstairs and get into the balcony to watch all these nasty horror films. And I was hooked.
Yeah.
So I remember one double feature was The Corpse Grinders and His Pals.
Yeah, Corpse Grinder. I remember that one.
And it was The Corpse Grinders, and then the other was The Undertaker and His Pals.
I didn't see The Undertaker's Pals, but I do.
I play that too. I played both those movies on American Horror.
And yes, there was a lot of Hammer horror.
I loved those in color.
With Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing.
I gotta admit that when I was a kid, I didn't enjoy the Hammer horror the way I do as an adult. When I was a kid, it had to be real for me. I gravitated towards super realistic horror, like Maniac, gory horror.
Oh, well, you know, Cannibal Holocaust.
That I enjoyed it. Yeah, Cannibal Holocaust, that kind of stuff. I play the trailers for that, like the live. I play the trailers, and that's part of the fun I like the idea of playing the. What I do is, okay, as an artist, I'm a painter. So I have a degree in art, and a lot of people forget that I'm an artist. So as I schedule the channel, there are things that don't match the texture of the film, the color of the film. I try to schedule trailers in the same era as the film. I'm trying to replicate what it was like for me as a boy growing up on the south side of Chicago and first discovering the VHS store. But I grew up next door to a grindhouse movie theater called The Lyric. And The Lyric was two movies for $1.50. And it was a grindhouse. And so my parents would let me and my brother and friends, we would all go there on Friday or Saturday night and see whatever the fuck they were playing. And I'm trying to replicate that experience with American Horror's The Channel.
So the kind of horror movies that I couldn't get into was like...
Well, they didn't care, Burl. They didn't care. They did not give a damn how old you were.
What is it, the ones with Jigsaw?
The Saw movies.
Yeah, I couldn't get into it.
The last Saw movie, which is a throwback to the Saw killer, is still alive. And he went to get a cure. He went to get
Chris
cured.
Rock, the lead actor in Sam Jackson was in the last one?
No, that was Chris Rock. This is after Chris Rock's performance.
Okay, so this is a film that came out after he did one.
Right, and this one is just a throwback to the same actor. He goes to Mexico for a cure for his cancer, but it's bogus.
Wow.
So he goes and collects all of the people that scammed him and puts them through the Saw ringer. It's really good.
See, now, I saw one of them, but it upset me so much I didn't watch any of
it. They spent so much time on the Rube Goldberg torture.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen a Serbian film?
I've heard of it, but no.
Okay, a Serbian film, I would warn anybody who's listening right now, because I think trigger warnings are bullshit. I think trigger warnings are for weak assholes, but a Serbian film has some truly damaging content, and there's some things in a Serbian film that will goddamn haunt you if you're a normal person. That film is a really good movie, by the way. Very well done, very well acted, but I understood where they were coming from with it, and I think it's kind of like Sallow.
Is that you that's...
100 Days of Sodom?
Yeah, is that you that's staticky? Or is that my headphones?
I hear the static also.
You're hearing the static also?
Yeah.
Is that happening, static?
Yeah, so you shy away from the torture porn, like Saw and Hostel.
On American Horrors, I try to stay away from that. Like, one of the most hardcore things we play is blood-sucking freaks. I get bored with it. I like suspense. I like a good suspense film. I like creepy. I like spooky. And I'm fine with gore. And I think that we, as horror fans, are really blessed because we have access to more content than we've ever had before. And we're able to communicate with each other and talk about these films and chat and share. So I think as a horror fan, we actually live in a pretty amazing time for horror. Even horror games like Doom or Dead space.
Or squid sound. The squid.
Really have a lovely life as a harpin. But at the same time, I think what's happening is, as creators, as writers, it's getting ground up fast because there is so much access. So a lot of the tropes are becoming cliches faster and faster.
That's true.
It's interesting, the current crop of horror, non-torture, but horror films, try very hard to come up with a fresh take.
That's why I really liked X and Pearl.
X and Pearl were fabulous. Pearl was really good.
Did you watch Terrifier?
Yes.
The crazy satanic clown?
Yes.
Yeah.
I looked at that and I'm going, well, that's a Stephen King ripoff.
Well, I get bored. I don't even feel that it's a Stephen King ripoff. It took me a while to wrap my brain around the Terrifier films because I know the filmmaker, Damien Leone. We showed the very first Art the Clown Terrifier short film on American Horrors in 2008, and I've been playing it ever since, and I've been watching the evolution of this character, and at first I was shut down by it, and I didn't get it. But then I had an epiphany in the last year and a half about what is this character about? What are these films about? And I got it. And it really hit me that it was a lot like the Italian Giallo films.
Suspiria.
And I didn't like those films when I was a kid. I did not like those. Okay, when I say Giallo for the audience at home, I'm talking about like The Gates of Hell, Dario Argento.
Yeah, Suspiria.
A lot of those films.
Yeah.
Suspiria. I love Suspiria. That's one of my favorite film scores. Because, Burl, when you write, do you put music on?
Quite often I will pick, this is weird, I will pick a certain album or a certain number of songs for that book.
Yeah.
And I will play those songs to the point of anyone else would drive them crazy to hear the same songs over and over again. But I'll play the same songs over and over again while I'm writing the book.
I do that.
I found that the music focuses the mind from wandering.
Yeah.
I've been writing the editorial for the reprint of the Dahmer book, and it's got a lot of crazy bad memories for me. And editing, I had one song that I put on repeat, and it was from a musician friend of mine, Scum Love, in Los Angeles. And Scummy, it's this The Devil May Sing. And I had this song on repeat, and I wrote the editorial over the several weeks, because sometimes in writing you will work on a piece and you'll get a couple pages in, and then you've got to walk away from it, and you come back with a different eye. And so to get my mind in the same zone, I use music all the time.
It's like a trigger mechanism. It puts you in that right frame of mind.
Yeah, and so I was listening to Scum Love's The Devil May Sing over and over, and it's a rhythm. You find this rhythm, and you're typing, and you're hitting the keyboard, and you feel this rhythm, and you're kind of possessed. I don't know what it's like for you, Burl, when you write, but I kind of leave myself, and I'm not quite there.
Yeah, that's because your brain waves change. You're going into an alpha state, 8 to 13 cycles per second, which is where your imagination, comprehension, thought, and memory are. If you get into the theta state, which is even lower, then you're liable to be unconscious.
Time is gone.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the great joys of being an artist, and one of the great joys of being a writer, and also it's one of the bonuses of being crazy, is that you leave time behind.
Yep, there is no time.
Outside of time.
Yeah, well, if you get in the alpha state, time doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I think that's why you're still alive.
Yeah, probably.
Because you don't exist in time anymore.
I'll tell you, I was driving, I was left Las Vegas, I was in a Mercedes-Benz turbo diesel wagon, and I was heading towards L.A. to take a right turn and head up to the Bay Area to see my daughter. And I would have petite ball seizures, and I didn't have my medication. But I always could tell ahead of time when I was going to...
You had them when you were driving?
Yeah. And I could tell ahead of time when I was going to have one. And I got the warning sign, and I saw, where's the next exit? And I said, oh, good, I can make the next exit and pull over, have it, and be okay. And I got to the exit closed. And so I'm going like 70-some miles an hour trying to make it to the next exit. And there was some road work, and there was a soft dirt on the side. Long story short, I flipped the car going 70 miles an hour, rolled across the freeway, broke through the guardrails, went airborne, and rolled over and over down the ravine with all the glass out of all the windows breaking.
Did you have your seatbelt on?
Yes, I did. What I did, the minute that car rolled, I leaned against the against the driver's side door and totally relaxed and just waited to see what happened. I said to myself, well, either I'm going to be dead or I'm not. Let's see what happens. Well, the car came to a stop finally on all four tires at the bottom of the ravine. And in my mind, I went, well, in the movies, on the count of four, the car blows up. So I opened the door and I stepped out. Quite, there's people looking down, right? They're looking down from the highway. I said, anybody up there got a cigarette? I'm feeling rather stressed. And I walked up, and California Highway Patrol showed up, and they looked down, and I had a giant stuffed frog that I was taking to my son, so it looked like a dead body in the car. And I said, I was the driver. And he goes, how could you make jokes when the person down there died a horrible death? And I said, no, I really am the driver of that car. So then he figured I was so banged. They figured that I was so in shock and banged up, you know, internal injuries, that I was near death. And he starts feeling my body. He goes, you're not hurt. I said, no, I realize that. He says, you don't even have a scratch on you from all the flying glass. I said, yeah, I realize that.
Yeah, that happened to me, Burl. I was involved in a horrendous 60-mile-an-hour car crash in Dallas, Texas. And it was the same kind of thing where I was in a super shuttle from the airport. I was going to my cousin's wedding. My cousin is actually a judge in Dallas, but back then she was a prosecuting attorney. And I was there for her wedding, and I was in the last super shuttle, blue super shuttle from the airport to go into Dallas, and we were involved in a 60-mile-an-hour car wreck where we were about 10 feet off the ground.
Jeez.
Something happened with one of the wheels, and the car was spinning through the air, and I was the only guy in the van that didn't have a seatbelt. Because my brother and I were the last people to get in the van, and it was with a bunch of old ladies that were there for their high school reunion. Ooh. Like their 40-year high school reunion, and I'm flying all over the van. I hit the van's roof. I'm okay, for the audience at home, hi, I'm Harty Fisher. I'm 6'2" and 235 pounds. I'm a big fella, and I got a lot of blonde hair. A lot of blonde hair.
Jealous.
I'm flying around this van, and I hit the ceiling, my back. I'm like literally like you're lying on your bed on the roof of the van.
That's a great visual.
Spinning around. And my brother seat-belted in, and he bounced off the ceiling, too. And he was looking out the window, and he's like, Hart's dead. We're dead. Hart's dead. He's not going to live. He does not have a seatbelt on. And we were coming over a bridge, and we almost went over the side of the bridge. The van hit the side of the bridge's retaining wall and was tipping over. And I remember looking out the window as we're tipping, and I'm coming off the ceiling, and I was thinking, you're about to find out what glass tastes like.
That's right.
That was the thought in my head. You're about to find out what glass tastes like. But we didn't fall over the bridge. We were okay. And Burl, just like you, buddy, I walked out of that wreck. I didn't have a goddamn scratch.
No.
But the little old ladies next to me that were going to the reunion that had their seatbelts on, they all went to the hospital.
Yep. No, the thing is that the roof of the car came down to a razor-sharp point exactly where my head had been. If I hadn't leaned against the door, my skull would have been split open. just like in a horror movie. Hey, we're out of time, Hart. Boy, this hour went by fast.
Thanks for joining us again.
I got to have you back on soon so we can keep this conversation going. Hey, run those true crime shows so I can see them.
Thank you very much, sir.
I'll program them.
Thanks, Hart. Love you.